Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Dr. Anastasia Karlinka Gabriel. And this is an extensive interview, and actually she's a second timer on The Deep Dive. So I want to underline that as well. So this is our second time having this conversation, and it's in celebration of her brand new book, first time book, I believe, Cultural Intelligence for Marketers, Building an Inclusive Marketing Strategy. She is a cultural theorist and strategist specializing in inclusivity within marketing, media, and tech. Currently a senior insights lead at Reddit, she earned her doctorate in cultural studies from Duke and has consulted for the world's top brands and agencies. She's a lifelong activist. She helps brands ignite cultural innovation and leverage the power of media for good. Her insights have been featured in Adweek, the Association of National Advertisers, Advertising Week, Wall Street Journals, New York Times, Washington Post, and Teen Vogue, all publications and media sites I'm sure we have all heard of and to some degree respect. So with all of that, it is a pleasure to welcome you back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, Phil. Thank you so much for having me back. It's a huge joy and pleasure.
Oh, that sounds so official. People say many things about being on this show. I don't know if joy is one of them, but you know, I'm going to lean into it. It's Tuesday. It's sunny in New York.
It is joyful. It is joyful to always talk to you, my friend. So I'm very excited to have this conversation.
Absolutely. I'm glad we're getting a chance to do this. Like we were kind of chatting a little bit before, and you know, we spend so much time in these digital spaces. We don't get an opportunity to really be with each other as much as possible, as likely as we would like, especially because we don't live in the same geography. But nonetheless, you're one of these people that has a what I would call like a meaningful social media impact, in the sense that the things that you remark on and post are incredibly important, incredibly insightful, and also things not often discussed in mediums like LinkedIn and other things. I want to really thank you for doing that kind of work and the intention behind it. I know it's not easy having a profile like that on social media, particularly in the times that we live in, you know. But nonetheless, the book is alive. It is in the flesh. And again, Cultural Intelligence for Marketers. So give me a sense of, A, how does it feel now that the book is out in the world? And what was sort of the origin story in genesis for taking on this topic?
It feels finally very gratifying and fulfilling, because as many writers know, the process of writing is quite lonely and arduous. And I completed this book while working full time. So there were many nights, early mornings spent toiling over this book. And now I get to be in the most gratifying part of this journey, which is be in conversation with other folks over the contents of this book. So I am certainly enjoying this part of the journey. As far as the book is concerned, I probably talked about it last time I was on the show. I come from an academic background and have always been very immersed in academic knowledge, particularly being trained in cultural studies. And when I transitioned into marketing and advertising shortly after 2019, I was immersed in this new space of corporate dialogue about issues of culture, inclusivity, identity, and so on. And I just had this moment when I kind of realized that, wow, the questions that we're asking in the business world, a lot of people have answered in the world of academy, in the world of activism, and just feel very passionate about kind of instilling a respect for other kinds of knowledge within the spaces that I now occupy in business. And as I was working on clients, speaking to colleagues, it felt that cultural studies can teach marketers a lot about how to navigate culture and how to create an inclusive marketing strategy. And so that's what the book is really about. I was hoping to bring concepts from cultural studies to the world of marketing and hopefully show how engaging other forms of knowledge can actually be helpful to people in the corporate world and make our work much more precise, inclusive, and just across the board better.
I love how you kind of described that journey. And, you know, when I was reading the book, it's incredibly insightful. So let's kind of get that kind of out of the way, so to speak, right?
Thank you.
I think anyone who is interested in understanding culture, I won't even say necessarily the marketing part of it, but if you are interested in cultural dialogue and how things unfold in the world, I think it's a must-have book. Now, on the flip side of that, and this wasn't one of my kind of note questions, but it's been running in the back of my mind. Like, as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, I don't really know if marketers are ready for a book like this, right? And maybe that's my own kind of perception of what I think of marketers. So I'm curious your thoughts on that, and I'm happy to expand on why I think they're not ready, but I'd rather like hear your thoughts on do you think they're ready for a book like this?
Well, first, I would love to hear your thoughts momentarily, because it is an intriguing question and certainly one that is top of mind all the time for me as somebody who thinks of themselves as a radical thinker navigating these spaces. And so part of the book was trying to translate ideas and make them legible to the world that perhaps doesn't think about issues of ideology and power and presentation and equity as, you know, the first thing that they think about when they go to work as a marketer.
Yeah, they ain't thinking about none of that.
None of that. So the book, in my mind, was trying to make these issues legible and palatable to, quote unquote, the establishment, while also remaining true to some of the intellectual traditions that I'm really indebted to. Is marketing ready? Possibly not. And I think it's certainly not ready for what I actually want the book to do. There's a kind of difference between what I think the book will do versus what I would love for it to do. And I go on a lot of these conversations, these podcasts, and I'm asked what I hope will transpire with this book or what I hope to see emerge in the space of marketing. And I really am not as hopeful as people want me to be, but this book is an effort to bring us a little bit closer to that. And I'm very grateful for my publisher for allowing me to go there and explore these ideas with the full creative and intellectual freedom that I'm not always allowed, you know, or I'm able to access in traditional corporate spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I try to stay away from the optimism question. I feel like it's one of those like gotcha questions. Like, you know, people will come on, not necessarily a show like mine, but other shows, and they'll kind of lament all these sorts of like challenges that they see in the world. And then, you know, the interviewer will be like, well, how do you feel about like the future? Right. And then right. the person has to kind of like put like a neat and tidy bow on things. Right.
Absolutely.
And I hate neat and tidy bows. Like they suck. Right. Like,
I'm with you.
But you know, with the marketers, the reason why I asked the question just for a little bit more context is one of the things I discerned in my career, and my career started in finance and Wall Street and then kind of shifted into a whole bunch of other stuff, that marketers were not really like creative or thoughtful. Like I actually feel like most marketers are operations people, you know, like I kind of remember talking to, you know, a marketer and like a very fun product, right? Like it was like juice packs, you know, like it was like stuff for kids. And you think like they're going to be doing something sort of like, you know, balloon animals or something, you know, I'm making a little bit of a joke. But all they cared about was like, where is this product showing up on like the shelves in Walmart and Target and, you know, BJ's and all that kind of stuff. Like they had no thought process at all about like the other stuff. It was just like, look, where are my SKUs? I got to visit all these stores and look at the shelves. And I was like, don't you think about the commercial? They're like, I don't give a shit. Like they just didn't care. Right. And nothing in the years since have changed my opinion of marketers, right? They're sort of like placeholders and they farm out all the other stuff to other people. Right. So that's why I asked the question. It's kind of like my low opinion of marketers, I guess.
That's a good question, because as we're talking, I'm thinking, well, who this book is for? And I suppose I did not actually write it for that type of marketer. And perhaps my target audience with this book is smaller than it should be, but I really wrote it for people that I am in community with within marketing spaces that do want to do better and that are wanting to be more conscious about the impact that their work has in the world and about how they understand and engage with cultural knowledge in their day-to-day work as marketers who probably share some of your opinions about marketers.
Yeah.
So it is a, you know, it is a project that is not aimed at convincing any of the old school traditional marketers around the importance of inclusivity and responsible media, because I'm not in the business of convincing anybody about that. But it aims to give some tools and some ways of thinking for those who are interested in, you know, have the courage to lean into that sort of thinking, even though that might not describe their day-to-day operations, yeah, as you mentioned.
And that kind of lets us go a little further in that, in the sense that, you know, is this, and it's not specific to marketers, like, you know, I'm going to always give marketers shit, right? But in I work with a lot of marketing folks and, you know, it's a gig, right? Like many other gigs. So it's less about them per se, but more about the sort of the larger milieu in which we operate in, right? In the sense that the ideas that you present are very challenging, right? And I think they're to these folks, right? Like it's weird because I'm like, this ain't really challenging at all in the sense that we ideologically probably land in the same thinking on, I would say probably 90% of shit, right?
Yes.
So I read your book and I'm like, wow, this is like, it's like empowering. People can't see, but I'm putting up like black fist power, right? Right. So in that part of the show, like imagine that, like, you know, there's a black fist that just went up. But other folks, they never heard of Stuart Hall, right? Like they don't understand like a black radical intellectual tradition that is often, if not mostly, anti-capitalist, right? So to restart to read that stuff, it's like, whoa, shit, we only knew about Martin Luther King, right? And we only know about that through one lens of I Have a Dream. Martin Luther King was also anti-capitalist, right? So that's what I mean by like, is that discomfort that they might feel in reading the book, do they then have the ability to exact change within the organizations that they might live in?
That's a big question, and it's a right one to ask. I'm not sure that the book can do all that, you know, in terms of equipping and empowering the readers who might not have prior experience in understanding culture through that lens to do all that and to be prepared to enact that change. But I see the book more so as an invitation and inspiration to explore, to lean into that, to pursue other ways of thinking and other ways of knowing the world of culture and the world of marketing. So in that sense, I don't aspire to change organizations at that level because, as I write in the book, the pace of change is slow. And I write quite a bit in the end, in the conclusion, around the kind of endurance and perseverance that is required of us to continue the work and continue leaning into it and continue exploring challenging and uncomfortable ideas. And so at the very least, I hope it's an invitation for marketers and business leaders for whom this sort of thinking, this sort of ideas are not even in their periphery. Like, they're not even part of their worldview or how they think about the impact that their work has on the world, to at least have a taste of it or a glimpse into it. Precisely to your point that you just made, you know, I held no illusions about the role that brands play in the larger structure of capitalism and how these systems function. So I think it would be naive to think that these ideas would travel into the corporate suites of the businesses that run these brands. But I do hope that it might incite some kind of conversation that might push things around just a little bit.
And, you know, And to be clear, I'm not even suggesting that we all think that like one book is going to do the thing, right? But because I think it's so important and the work is so important, and I probably lean maybe a little differently in the sense that I feel like a lot of the C-suite folks, they will kind of like use like some of the notions of this. Like, it's almost like they're... It's a good example. Again, this was not a prepared train of thought, so I'm kind of working through it. But I think about, for example, BlackRock, right? Huge financial organization. They got their tentacles in everything. And their CEO in more recent years was famous for like writing this letter that kind of everybody would read. And it was like filled with these sort of like, for that crowd, revolutionary ideas. Right? Like, we need to restructure the way we think about capitalism. And, you know, you'll hear the capitalism for good and, you know, all these different monikers and stuff. Right? And it's not that far afield from some of the very important and challenging ideas that you and many others have put forth. Like, it would read on the surface, like, it's like, oh, wow, they're understanding more things. Like, there's hope, right? But yet there don't change, like, he doesn't change anything in the way BlackRock operates, right? Like, it just sounds good, gets people excited. So my thought is, how do you feel, because these things do take time, right? That it can be like a glacial drip to actually enact the changes, not necessarily maybe at his level, and he's just one example, but of more in the weeds, right? So we'll often hear people say, oh man, if only someone was in the room that knew better, right? Then we wouldn't have whatever the shit thing is that we're complaining about on the other side. And I read your book and I felt like, well, this could be the guidebook for those people that are in this metaphorical room where these decisions are getting made. So do you think that when they're sitting there, that person, that they could say to themselves, they could be the raising of the hand to say, like, I don't know about this, right?
Well, I certainly hope that part of what the book inspires is the kind of art of questioning, right? Because what you're pointing to is actually a conversation that I don't think marketing community is even ready for. In the book and broadly, in conversations around cultural inclusive marketing, we talk about primarily representation, how we represent ideas, people, narratives in the kind of campaigns that as marketers we put out into the world, where, well, we haven't even started the conversation about how brands and businesses operate beyond the marketing comms that are being put out, whether that's treatment of workers, supply chain ethics, and so on and so forth. So that kind of structural critique of brand-driven businesses is so necessary, but also quite far away from us within this space. But I do hope that even if the book does not kind of provide tangible tools, you know, for a revolution inside these corporate spaces, at least it does provide inspiration for some questioning for that person to raise their hand. Because a really book asks, what's missing here? It asks and invites marketers to learn how to ask, what am I missing? What is being glossed over here? What is being silenced? Which is why I talk about ideology and power for so many pages throughout the book. It's really learning to ask those questions and to be an unpopular voice in the room, which is what I try to model in the work that I do outside of the book. So the art of questioning and the skill of being the unpopular voice in the room does strike me as important to the arc of social change, even as the process itself is painfully slow, as we know, from history and our own present conjuncture.
Absolutely. And, you know, representation is always like a tricky one, right? And I think about it constantly. Because on one level, as a human moving in the world, I'm like, yeah, it feels good to see other people, right? Like I will opt into a show or something just because I'm like, oh, wow, you know, I see more different kinds of people, right? So if your show is like too white, like if you're Ozarks, I'm not really fucking with you, right? And I heard Ozarks is amazing, but just intrinsically in my brain, I was like, you know what? Too many white people in that show, right? Like in a particular narrative that I feel like I've seen that show before, right? It's the tortured white guy who's doing something and he's an anti-hero. I'm like, okay, I saw Breaking Bad. Like, I don't need to watch another one of those. But if you sprinkle, you know, some different kind of folks, I might have opted into Ozarks, right? You know, so I don't think that representation doesn't matter. I think it does, but it's not the whole thing, right? And so how do you, as you think through these topics, you know, you talk about cultural fluency a lot, right? So I want to also within this question, give you an opportunity to kind of define that and then kind of use that to kind of think, let's kind of talk through like representation and where it's helpful, where it's not, and how it matters and all that kind of stuff.
I love that question because part of what I am trying to do is help marketers and anyone who is kind of related to the work of communications to rethink how we understand representation. And what I mean by that is that it seems very important for us to start moving away from this idea of representation as who is represented, to how they're presented, what kind of stories are being told, and specifically focusing on one term that you mentioned, which is narrative. What kind of narrative are we putting out into culture? Because as we know, we can put quote unquote diverse stories out there in a way that signal diversity for the sake of it, but are not actually engaged in authentic, accurate representations of people, their communities, and the kind of messages, or are just using diversity as a kind of checkbox, right, to shield conceal some of the perpetually harmful messages that we receive through mass media. So I am particularly interested in thinking of representation through the lens of messaging and what kind of messaging are brand as producers of media sending into culture, whether that's related to who is desirable in culture, who is beautiful, who belongs and who doesn't belong, representations of how we live our lives, what families look like, etc. Because so much of advertising mass media really shapes those ideas. So that for me is a major priority in how I'm trying to develop the understanding of what representation actually is. And for that reason, to get to your second question, I talk about cultural fluency in the context of advertising and marketing through three concepts of subversive storytelling, what I call power shifting, and inclusive innovation.
And to me, that's the ethos of cultural intelligence as I understand it, where this commitment to counter stereotyping, to more inclusive design is baked into how we understand what it means to engage in culture. And certainly to your point earlier, that's probably quite far away from what traditional MBA class will teach you about marketing, but that's where my head is with it.
That's so important, right? Because representation, we see it in like what I'll call like, it's not that I'm creating the space, but I'm using like pop culture spaces for like the big capture of like everything we consume, right? That's sort of like TV, music, movies, books, all that kind of stuff, right? I'm just lumping all of that into imperfectly like pop culture, right? Then we have like social / political structures, right? Which I'm kind of saying imperfectly again, everything else, right? And you'll see these conversations all the time with like, oh, you know, that the casting is different in this. Like, look, there's plus size models now, or, you know, everybody's like super inky black, right? So we've kind of moved away from like the classic sort of, you know, Cindy Crawford-esque model. And now we just have like someone super dark, like darker even than me, right? So I'm kind of like Hershey Kiss brown, but they went into like super, super dark brown, right? To just prove a point, right? Like when I see that, I feel like they're proving a point, right? And then on the flip, we have like the Biden administration, right? Where people be like, oh, it's one of the most diverse administrations. And look, there's an indigenous woman who's in charge of the, you know, Secretary of the Interior. And look, there's this person, black guy, who's Department of Defense. And I'm like, so, right? Like, you know, like having that person kill black and brown people around the world, that doesn't help me, right? So I don't look at him and be like, oh, wow, great. That the face of imperialism and empire is now this black guy, right? Like that's fucking sucks to me, right? So I'm curious again how we parse through representation, whether it's sort of like quote unquote frivolous, even though I don't think pop culture is frivolous. I live in pop culture worlds very deeply, or these more significant worlds where you are seeing the face of power, right? It's the Hillary Clinton argument. Like she's Secretary of State. I'm like, and Margaret Thatcher was the first prime minister that was a woman in the UK. She was terrible, right? So having a woman, if she doesn't have the values, isn't cool. It's just like having a black person. Clarence Thomas is the worst, right? Like I wake up every day hoping when I see that dude trending that he's dead. You know, you don't have to say all these things, but I could say them, right? Because, you know, so I'm not putting you on the spot to agree or disagree that Clarence Thomas should die, but Clarence Thomas should die. You know, but these are the things I wrestle with, right? So I'm curious your thoughts about that mishmash of stuff that I just said.
For that reason, precisely, I want us to think about representation and ideology together. Because we are in these circles where it is assumed that all inclusivity, empathy is beneficial. And I'm actually doing a talk later this month where I talk about the racial politics of empathy and ways in which who we empathize with, for example, not to go on a tangent, can be really violent and can be really harmful when we privilege some groups over others.
And tangents are allowed on the show, by the way.
Like, wonderful, wonderful.
I should have renamed it the deep tangent.
The deep tangent. I love it. Well, and so ideology seems very important. And to the point I made earlier about having a culture of questioning, asking what purpose do narratives, forms of representation serve? Because when I hear you talk, what I think about immediately is the concept from the work of Professor of Ethnic Studies, Dr. Dylan Rodriguez, from quite a few years ago, where he named the era that we are in right now as an era of desegregated white supremacy. And that I couldn't put in the book because I don't know that my readers are ready for that, you know, but
that
I do
might be
believe
a dicey one.
A dicey one. But I do believe that's how we should view the current moment and the contingencies of the present, the struggles that we are in. And that is also precisely why I spent quite a bit of time in the introduction and the inclusion of the book, kind of leaving the traditional business path of marketing and talking about the history of the civil rights movement and the history of queer liberation movements and feminist movements, to precisely say that this is not just about being a quote unquote good white person in position of power and doing well and including quote unquote these people, which is still the mentality that a lot of people in the establishment within marketing and business have, but an ongoing struggle that is related to these wider social political structures that you just referenced. And in order to do good, not just because, but actually enact radical social change, which is certainly what I'm interested in, we have to be engaged in that wider understanding of the present moment as one where representation functions, I guess, to bring it back to full circle, as a form of ideology and a form of whitewashing and a form of diluting demands for radical social change that a lot of us are trying to bring forth into the world.
You know, it's a constant reimagining, right? Where I feel almost this is, I know people out there are like, you know, we have to be very conscious of mental wellness, right? So I'm going to use words that, again, are imperfect. So anyone who suffers from these things, please do not email me because I will not respond to you. But it can make you feel like a schizophrenic in some ways, right? And I'm not using that in a clinical sense. So again, doctors, do not email me because I will not respond to you. In the sense that I could sit here and watch like Bridgerton, for example, right? Filled with representation, you know, South Asian communities, Black folks, all set in this sort of, you know, colonial time UK. And be like, man, it wasn't that easy for them people in that world, right? And I'm putting it lightly, right? And I'm like, well, you know what? I like Shonda Rhimes, you know, so I'm going to kind of fuck with it, right? And suspend what I know of the transatlantic slave trade in order to sit there for an hour and watch Bridgerton and not get into it, right? But then on the flip, I live in a world where I do acknowledge the transatlantic slave trade and the ill effect that it has had for centuries, right? So again, it can put you in this sort of like disconnection, maybe is the better word, where you have to suspend a lot of what you know in order to enjoy this one thing. And also, I'm not going to fall on every sword to fight against, like, oh man, why'd you show? You know, like, I just can't be that person that's like mad and cranky all the time, right? And I feel that's a whole other industry. So I say all that to say, like, when you talk about cultural fluency, how does that connect to, or do you think it does at all, with what I think about, like, our multiplicity of identity? Right. Where I live in this world and inhabit many different things within who I am as a person. Right. And as someone starts to parse that cultural fluency and use this, how do they capture all of that in or can they? Is it even possible to sort of think through all the little pieces of who we might be and how we connect the things in order to come up with like something that is palpable to people, right? Because I feel like no matter what you do, you're going to kind of lose something out, right? Because someone might say, oh, he's a Black guy, but I'm like, yeah, but I'm West Indian, right? So a lot of like, when they be like, oh, Black people love soul food, I'm like, not really, right? Like, I didn't grow up eating that. I grew up eating something else. But to the eye, they'd be like, oh, of course. Chicken, mac and cheese, watermelon, just joking.
As you're talking, I picked up the word of multiplicity of our identities. And as you continue talking, what stood out to me is the way that actually identity functions as this kind of policing force where we do label people and assign our value judgments, stereotypes, assumptions about who they are. And that's very much part of how identity functions, even though, as you say, we are complex, multifaceted, not set in stone, right? And can engage with culture in a kind of contradictory manner where we consume something that is clearly quote unquote problematic, for lack of a better term, right? And then talk about radicalism and radical social histories and et cetera. And I don't know that I have an answer, but I have been thinking quite a bit about this idea of purity and, you know, the kind of, and how seductive purity can be, where we, you know, I think we see that in contemporary culture, specifically around even some of the activist discourse that proliferates in online spaces, where you're either this or for that. You're either, you know, say one thing or you say the other thing, and there is kind of no gray area. And so that brings me back to my point of the ways that identity has, in certain respects, become appropriated to be a force of division and a force of us versus them in a way that actually prohibits us from dwelling in the nuance and dwelling in the contradictions. Because as you were talking and describing Bridgerton, for example, I was thinking about Stuart Hall's work and how he would think about audiences who are on receiving end, which is that we never really passively receive or consume the media. There's always a process of where we are negotiating, where we're creating a different reading. So in that moment, are you really passively consuming that form of media, or is your self-awareness a form of negotiating it and forming a kind of critique, which now we are talking about, you know, on your podcast? And so I do believe in that, the importance of that critical discourse. And I just don't know that it always looks, as, you know, to your early point, as prettily packaged bow on top kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so hard, right? So that's why I love the book so much, right? And kind of the engagements that I've been kind of privy to watching you in real time meaning like online, kind of work through these issues, because I think it is so relevant to the large and small conversations. So that you do see this in activist spaces, which is why it's so interesting. Like I literally have in my notes, like identity has splintered the left to a certain extent, right? Where you get into smaller and smaller buckets. And I'm not in this like, oh, the left is particularly dysfunctional, right? So I don't believe in that. So I'm not having that conversation where, you know, what do idiots say? Oh, the left didn't leave. I didn't leave the left. The left left me, or whatever. You know, those sort of like corny things that, you know, a lot of liberals say when they just don't want to send their kids to public school, right? Like, you know, they're trying to hide it behind all this sort of like seemingly higher thinking. It's like, no, you just don't like Black people. Stop pretending. You like Obama, but you don't like other Black people. But this sort of, when this fluency and this cultural intelligence that you talk about, and I want to give you an opportunity to introduce that specifically. We've kind of talked about it a little bit, but I want to give you an opportunity to name it. It seems like there's so many ramifications to work that can bring us together. You know, a marketer could use it, obviously, to do better work within the already defined confines of empire and capitalism. And then maybe others can also pick up the book and say, hey, maybe we can work more in solidarity with one another because we can more use these tools or guidelines or frameworks of cultural fluency and cultural intelligence to better understand each other and where we're coming from. So I'm curious if I'm overly hopeful in that regard, or if maybe there's a stealthy way in which we can pull this all back together.
I certainly hope you are not wrong. Even though the book is titled Cultural Intelligence for Marketers, I really hope that it provides a way of thinking about how messaging works, whether one is a marketer or a creative or a researcher or engage in some way, shape, or form in the work of communicating ideas and messages to the wider public or specific audiences and so on. And so in that sense, I go in the book through what I call these four C's, which is culture, communication, critical consciousness, and community. And so I really hope that there are bits and pieces there that can help folks think, you know, how culture works, how messaging is disseminated, received, negotiated, and so on, and how we can be a little bit more conscious about the impact that our work has in the world, because that's really what the book is about, how messages travel through culture and society, how they shape our values, beliefs, what we consider valuable, et cetera, and how we can become a little bit more conscientious about the impact that it has in the world. Ultimately, I think the premise of the book project and what I'm trying to do is really to say that nothing just exists in the world and nothing can be divorced from the social and political structures that we inhabit. So our work is to always be engaged with questions of power. Who does it empower? Who does it marginalize? Who does it benefit? Who is left behind? And so that overall ethos, I hope, is something that readers can take with them in whatever space they operate in on a daily basis.
It kind of brings me to sort of the brand and culture conversation, which is always, to me, like a yin and yang, right? Like, are brands influencing culture, or is culture influencing brands, right? Is the classic chicken and egg, I guess, to a certain extent. And I think about, like, there's a couple of brands that I just kind of thought about for the purposes of these notes, right? Like, you have Patagonia, can't get more crunchy, save the world. And these are good things, right? I realize sometimes I sound sarcastic, but I don't actually love Patagonia. But yet their vest, for example, is sort of the de facto look for hedge fund douchebags and like venture capitalists, right? Complete opposite. Fred Perry, same thing. It becomes the uniform for like the Proud Boys and other white supremacists and Hawaiian shirts, right? Like, people might not know this, but there's a lot of white nationalist movements that stealthily wear like these Hawaiian shirts, and it's part of this like neo-revolutionary planning to overthrow the government world, right? You might just see a dude walking around in a Hawaiian shirt, but that motherfucker might have like a bunker and might want to take you out, right? Or he could be a very nice guy. We don't know. But these things are out there, right? And they're very far from their intended purposes, right? But yet others have taken them and made them into something else. And so these things ebb and flow. So I'm curious, and I gave some very extreme examples for a reason, right? But I'm curious your thoughts on how that yin and yang work. Like, is it the brand putting themselves in the culture? Is it the culture kind of impacting the brand?
Well, Phil, this is such a good example of this notion, and I might use some of these examples in another conversation elsewhere, because it is such a evidence for how brands are actual like vessels of meeting. Their symbols, they operate much like symbols have operated in the past, right? So in the book, I even write about precisely that, how we identify with somebody wearing a cross, for example, and we intuitively know what that stands for. They're signaling to others what they believe, what they stand for, etc. And so it's interesting to think about brands as functioning in a very similar way, where brands acquire meaning. And so you can be wearing Patagonia and the meaning could be intended as one, but then takes on a life of its own within culture to acquire other kinds of meaning. And I guess my perspective on that is that that's something that can't necessarily be controlled. And that's in many ways the beauty of culture, not to suggest that the answers you pointed out are necessarily positive ones, but it points to the idea that culture is
very dynamic and ever evolving, and it's not static. And in ways, brands are symbols that get taken up to mean certain things. And that's exactly how we signal to others who we are. So somebody might be wearing a Hawaiian shirt and signaling something about themselves. I might be wearing Nike and signaling to myself and others something else that I'd like to believe about myself, you know, how I'm athletic, which I'm not. But, you know, these kind of aspirational narratives that we attach to these objects. And so I don't know that there's a way to stop that or if that we even should. But again, to my point earlier, I think it draws our attention to the role of ideology and meaning in representation, right? How representation cannot be reduced to just who is represented or how the intended meaning is packaged into something. It's always going to be up for interpretation. It's always going to be taken up by the public and reinterpreted. And all we can do is be more mindful of that process in order to do this work more fluently, inclusively, and equitably to the point that we can within that process.
You know, and you know, all of this is shorthand, right? Like if I see a dude walking around with some Oakleys, I'm like, uh-oh. You know, you probably got a red hat in your back pocket. I gotta watch myself around you, right? Or you could just, like, you know, be out there in the world just playing a lot of golf. I don't know. Like, I guess both those things can exist at the same time. But that's what makes it really interesting, right? Is that these conversations just end up, you go in so many different places. Before we get to the drop, which is going to be the final segment of the show, I want to get you out on this. You know, I spend a lot of time in foresight spaces thinking about future design and a lot of fancy words for trying to figure out how to make this work better. And I was curious your thoughts on if you saw cultural intelligence as maybe a branch of or a part of a foresight practice, you know, kind of how do we think about not just the world that we are currently in, but get smarter / more intelligent in order to make potentially better worlds in plural. And then we'll get to the drop.
Certainly and absolutely. I spend a lot of time in my doctoral studies thinking about the future. I mean, my dissertation is on abolitionist imagination. So a lot of that is the ethos behind it, even though I only touch on futures research and futures thinking tangentially as a way to signal to marketing readers that that's one area of work that is involved in cultural intelligence. But I do think overall, this idea of transforming culture cannot happen unless we are able to imagine an otherwise. So to me, the work of cultural and social change is always one of being engaged with what we might call, per Foucault, the history of the present, but then also the future possibility of where we want culture to go and where we imagine it being in world that we want to bring out, because how otherwise would we know the changes we need to make in the present unless we are able to imagine the kind of futures that we want to author and bring forth into being? So to me, the present and the work that we are doing now to change the system that we inhabit is always already attached to the future that we want to bring forth. So I love that question and thank you for asking it.
Oh, see, I went out on a high note. Little did I know, I ended it on a high note. So this has been wonderful. You know, I feel already that I got to book you for a part two because I left like a ton of notes on the table that I haven't even gotten into so many questions, which just speaks to the relevance and the really breath and devotion to your work. So I thank you for doing it. So the drop is an opportunity for us to share anything at all with our listeners. It doesn't have to be anything serious. It can be, because people always say, oh my, they get nervous about the drop. So I'm like, hey, calm down. It's very simple. It can be anything. So I have actually two drops One is a documentary on HBO Max, because I refuse to call that shit Max or whatever stupid brand name that they decided to slap on it for their poorly managed service. It's called Brandy Helville, and it's all about the Brandy Melville brand. It's a fast fashion brand, and it kind of tells the story of the toxic effects this brand has had on, literal toxic effects this has had on the environment, as most fast fashion does, but also on the well-being and mental health of many of the devoted consumers of the brand, which are primarily women, young women, tweens, teens, and everything in between, right? Deeply misogynist culture, racist, kind of all the things you would probably expect from a bunch of fucking assholes who run a brand like this. But it's a great documentary. Then it's called Brandy Helville, a play off the brand itself, Brandy Melville. And my other drop is a movie featuring one of my favorite actors, Jeffrey Wright. It's called American Fiction. He was nominated for Best Actor. He did not win that. And the movie was nominated for Best Picture. It didn't win that either. But very, very good movie. And I feel in some ways the topic of the movie plays with some of the topics that we've talked about. So I'm not going to give it away to anybody who hasn't seen it, but read this book, watch that movie, and it'll all make sense. And those are my drops. So you're up.
Yes. I was thinking of what to suggest and trying to come up with a pop culture recommendation, but you know me, I like my books. So I was pacing back and forth here near my bookshelf and decided that I wanted to shout out another author whose book I find to be fantastic. And it's a kind of text that you pick up and you go, oh, I wish I wrote this instead. You know, this is my maybe next book project or inspiration for my next book project. But it's written by Dr. Francesca Sabandi, and it's called Big Brands Are Watching You: Marketing, Social Justice, and Digital Culture. It's a really interesting, thoughtful, critical take on the role of brands in social justice activism and the way that brands take up social causes to both participate in them, but also signal a certain morality and progressiveness to audiences. And it's just a fascinating read about the intersection of corporate culture, consumer culture, and social movements. And so Dr. Sabandi is a senior lecturer in digital media studies at Cardiff University. So I wanted to shout this book out.
That sounds like a good one. I love it. And co-option, years ago, I wrote a whole essay on why co-option is one of the greatest threats to our culture, so to speak. Folks will come in and, you know, it's just like COINTELPRO destroying the Panthers, right? They get in and then they fuck your whole shit up. So that's a wonderful drop. I'm definitely going to have to get a copy of that. Dr. Anastasia, and I want to underline that doctor part because you earned it and we should celebrate it. It was always good to see your work, engage with your work. I want to thank you so much for joining me on the deep dive. We got to do a part two of this conversation, but a part three for you being on the show, because there's so much that we didn't get to, but this was amazing. Thank you so much.
I would be most honored. Thank you. And to repeat where we started, an absolute joy and pleasure. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thank you.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.